I'm Josephine, and this is the February edition of From Mountains to Molecules.
Imagine there's no heaven. See if you try.
Today I'm here with Holly, Trudy and Mio, and we are going to dispel some of the myths about climate change. But first, we have our usual article of science in the news. So, what's been happening recently then? First thing that we've got in the news is obviously about the flooding. So we have 10 more days of difficult conditions due to flooding. The Midlands and Wales are preparing for another 10 days of flood conditions. Evacuations have already happened at Bewdley in Worcestershire, where the river overtopped the defences, and at Ironbridge in Shropshire, where flood barriers have buckled under the sheer weight of the water, which is now seeping underneath. The Environment Agency estimate up to 500 tonnes of water is passing Ironbridge every second. Although river levels are now falling, another band of rain is arriving at the weekend. The Environment Agency incident rooms will be manned 24/7 for another 10 days with staff at all barriers.
Joe, hold on a second. So why isn't the ground soaking up the water?
Well, normally the soil and the plants soak up rainwater a bit like a giant sponge, which slows it down on the way to the river. But with the amount of rain that we've had over the past few weeks, the sponge is already full of water and it's no longer soaking up some of that rain. And when that happens, it just means that all the rain tries to get into the river at once. If the river isn't big enough to handle the water, the river will flood.
Yeah, I think an important point for homeowners and local government is actually that the effectiveness of this sponge that we're talking about is also affected by the amount of land that it's built up. So the more concrete, the more paved driveways, the more car parks there are, the less water can be absorbed. And the faster the river levels are going to rise and the higher the river levels are going to peak. So I think that's something that we should all be aware of, particularly if we're homeowners, really. Okay, so moving on to something that is also a little bit unnerving. So we've had extreme flooding in the UK, but we've also had the highest ever temperature recorded in Antarctica. The temperature in Antarctica hit a record of 20.75 degrees C a few weeks ago, just days after breaking the previous record. To put that into context, it's the average temperature for London in June. So the World Meteorological Organization have described the new record as incredible and abnormal. Now, Antarctic summers are usually average just above freezing, but scientists say the extreme temperatures in the area of the Antarctic appear to be caused by shifts in ocean currents and El Nino events. Now, the lowest temperature ever recorded was minus 89.6 degrees C, and that was recorded at Vostok, which is a Russian research station on Antarctica, in 1983. But this 20.75 degrees a few weeks ago is quite a shocking thing, to be honest. If you think about how cold Antarctica normally is, this new temperature record is quite extreme. So, Trudy, can you tell us a little bit more about El Nino, which is having this big impact?
Right. So, an El Nino is an event that affects the global climate and disrupts normal weather patterns, resulting in extreme weather all around the globe. It is caused by weak trade winds across the Pacific, allowing warm water to move further east than normal. El Nino occurs about every 2 to 7 years as part of a natural cycle and could cause storms and increased rainfall in one place, like Africa, and droughts in another, like Australia. So El Nino is a warm event, but it has a sister, La Nina, which is a cold event, which has almost the opposite impact.
Right, so it's interesting that this happens, isn't it? I think the geographers, the undergraduate geographers, actually study about El Nino and La Nina, so I'm sure they would be able to tell us quite a bit more. We'll have to get one of them on at some point to talk about it. Okay, so just something a little bit more cheerful before we move on to our special interview. Music and cats. So, Mio, what kind of music do your cats like? Do they like classical, rock? Are they pop music fans?
I guess they like classical music.
Like classical music. Oh, so yours are sophisticats.
Aristocats.
Aristocats. Fantastic. Okay, well, a new study has been finding out what cats really enjoy listening to. Researchers at Louisiana State University School of Veterinary Medicine wanted to see if music could have a calming effect on a cat suffering from stress. And they studied 20 different cats, and they played 3 different types of music to them while they were getting a checkup at the vets to see how they'd react. So the cats were listening to silence, classical music, and a specifically designed cat music. What is that, you might say? But the music that's designed for cats includes special purring sound effects to make the felines feel like a kitten again. And they found that listening to the cat-specific music before and during their trip to the vets reduced their stress levels and helped them to feel calm. So, Mio, next time you take your cat to the vets, you want to put a little bit of purring music on in the background. Well, I think we'll move on to our next song now, and then we'll come back for our interview.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an aeroplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world serves its own needs. Dummy serve your own needs. And burn, return, listen to yourself churn. Locking in, uniform and book burning, blood letting, every motive escalate, automotive centering. Light a candle, light a motive, step down, step down. Watch a heel crush, crush, uh-oh, this means no fear. Cavalier, renegade, steer clear. Tournament, a tournament, a tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world. It's the end of the world.
Colonel drifted by a mountain, sit in a line, Leonard Bernstein, Leonard Brasnap, Lenny Bruce and Lester Banks, birthday party, cheesecake, jelly bean, boom, symbiotic, patriotic, slam, boom, nap, right?
Dr. Andrew Kithriotis. Would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself, Edward?
Yeah, so I'm a professor in climate science and meteorology in the School of Geography and Lincoln Center for Water and Planetary Health, University of Lincoln. My work concerns melting ice sheets, climate change and extreme weather events. So I'm also interested in looking at the jet stream and links between Arctic climate change and what's happening in lower latitudes such as the UK.
That sounds fascinating. Andrew, what about you?
Yes, I'm a senior lecturer in political and social geography in the School of Geography at University of Lincoln. And my work primarily revolves around the governance of climate change and how people and institutions work together to actually tackle climate change.
Well, you two sound like the perfect people to discuss this topic with then. So our topic this week is talking about climate change. And what we really wanted to focus on were some of the issues that people bring up regarding whether they believe in climate change or not. People call it climate change denial. Now, we've sort of worked out that there are three stages of climate change denial. So you have this total denial, which is basically climate change, global warming, it's not real, it's not happening. That's total denial. Stage two would be it's not our fault. So Earth is warming, but humans aren't causing it. And then we've got phase three, which is sort of a resignation. So climate change is real, but actually it's not that bad a thing. It's actually okay. It's going to get a nice bit warmer, things like that. So what I'd like to do today is just address some of those issues with you if I can. So starting with this phase one, this absolute total denial about climate change and global warming. One of the things that people say, and this is one that I find quite amusing now being in academia, is that climate scientists are in it for the money. What would be your response to that?
So, well, my answer to that would be that I think we love the research that we're doing. We're addressing an important problem that's of concern to us all. And a lot of us a lot of outreach and voluntary activities anyway. And we're in this on a voluntary basis before we had a career in the subject. So certainly it's something that does get criticised, but also we have many skills collectively that many of us could work in other industries where we would get paid at least as much, if not more. But we're lucky to have, obviously, a career we really enjoy doing, but it's really critically important to try and address some of these issues.
Absolutely, and that kind of links into some of the other comments that people made about how some of the scientists that are dealing with this are exaggerating sea level rise. It's part of a conspiracy. You might have heard some of this language coming from the United States in particular. Manipulating data to show a warming trend. So, Andrew, what do you think about this idea of scientists potentially manipulating the data?
Well, scientists do not manipulate the data, and I think this is the thing that a lot of climate denialists have taken on board with respect to cherry picking data is one example. So if you typically see a graph showing an increase in temperature over an amount of time, say 40 to 50 years, it would show a net increase in temperature. But what denialists tend to do is take a proportion of that graph and look at the data over 5 years, where they can actually infer a minimal amount of cooling. But if you look at that graph over the longer temporal period, it would actually show a complete warming phase. And that's one example of how the denialists try to use the scientists to further their own ideology.
So it's a bit like lies, damn lies and statistics. So let's look at some of the other things that they talk about. They talk about this idea that Antarctica gaining ice, glaciers growing, the southern sea ice increasing, things like that. So, Edward, obviously this is your area, this is ice. So do you want to tell us a little bit more about what your thoughts are on that?
Yes, so nearly all glaciers globally are currently losing mass and retreating, so something like more than 9 tenths, and particularly the ice sheets are losing something like a combined 400 billion tonnes of ice mass per year, which is contributing to between a quarter and a third of the current sea level rise over the last 10 years or so. If you look down at the regional level, of course there are differences and anomalies. So, for example, the frozen part of the ocean, the sea ice around Antarctica, has actually been grown slightly. It's true overall over the last three or four decades. But overall, sea ice, particularly in the Arctic, is also retreating very, very rapidly. So again, it's a case of collectively looking at what the ice is doing. And there is a very distinct and rapid global warming signature in those changes.
Okay, so Andrew, a question for you. In the 1970s, I don't know if you can remember the 1970s, scientists said that we were heading towards a new ice age. They just keep changing their minds. How can we trust this?
Actually, the vast majority of climate papers in the 1970s actually predicted warming. Changing the idea, I think it's actually quite difficult to change these sort of ideas, because once they're put out there on things like social media, people tend to actually go with that as an influencer. And I've got a perfect example of that. I was at the Lincolnshire show last year, and a lady came into our geography stand, and she said, "What do you do?" I said, "Well, I explained about my role and that I do work on climate change, the governance of climate change." And she says, "I don't believe in climate change. It's actually climate change is caused by the CIA." So then we got into this not heated, but a rather wordy conversation about how, you know, the peer review process in science and how it all works and how we actually review what constitutes proper science. But half an hour later, she still walked away saying, I still believe that climate change is caused by the CIA because I read it on Google.
And I think the difficulty with any conspiracy is that you can't challenge it, because the moment you challenge it, you become part of the conspiracy. So it's and when they're Googling things, we've talked about this positive confirmation bias, this idea that when you're looking for something, you will look and you will. So if we take this a link, sort of very similar subject about the autism and vaccines, people will do their own research on Google to try and find out information about whether vaccines cause harm, and they will find 100 sites that say vaccines do not cause harm, and they will find one site that says it does, and that's the one they fixate on. And that's what confirmation bias is. You keep looking because you think something's wrong until you find the answer you're looking for. So it's almost impossible to deal with the conspiracy, I think. So what about this one then, Edward? Extreme weather events have happened before, so are not linked to global warming. This is very apt at the moment, isn't it, with all the flooding?
Yes, well, of course, it's true that there's always extreme events. But if we look at the number and intensity of extremes that have occurred over the last few decades, and, for example, there's some independent economic data from the global reinsurance company Munich Re that I also show a lot in talks and lectures, by the way. There's been a very significant increase in most types of extreme events that are linked to meteorological, hydrological and climatological causes rather than geophysical. So the earthquakes, tsunamis and volcanoes, they've remained fairly stable over the last few decades in terms of the economic losses, whereas the meteorological, climatological related events have more than doubled over that period since about 1980 or so. So it's really looking at the collective body. And of course, in the last decade in particular, we're all aware of a clustering of heat waves, floods, extreme rainfall episodes in many parts of the world, and it's really looking at the body of these events collectively that is providing evidence for the impacts of global warming through human-driven greenhouse gas increases.
Okay, so for anybody who's now been convinced, if you were a climate change denier before and are now thinking, well, maybe climate change is happening, maybe the Earth is warming, but it's not really our fault, humans aren't causing it, you are in phase two of denial. So, phase two, scientists actually don't agree on human-caused climate change. There's no consensus. What do you think about that one?
Well, I think that There is agreement from the vast majority of physical climate scientists, as evidenced through the through papers that are published and also reviews of those papers. And I'm sure Andrew may have some things to say about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, but that's just one example of where a vast body of work is brought together from scientists globally, and there basically is consensus. There's never absolute complete agreement in any branch of science, but it's certainly the vast majority of climate scientists who accept the evidence for global warming has been influenced through human activity.
What springs to mind when you talk about that, Edward, is I was given a lecture last week, and as part of that lecture I showed the video The Great Warming Swindle. Mm-hmm. It was a programme that was aired on Channel 4 about 10 years ago, a year after Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth came out, and that was shown at the cinemas. And it basically showed scientists actually not agreeing with the consensus. Yeah. But actually what happened out of that, there was actually an Ofcom review because of what they were publishing, what they were showing to the UK public. And a lot of those complaints were actually upheld. And it shows how the media often portrays this idea that scientists don't agree with climate change. They portray it as a 50-50 argument. So they would have a climate denier on one side of the interview and a scientist. And that is not the true representation.
Yes.
So if you wanted a true representation, you'd probably have to fit 4,000 climate scientists into the studio compared to one denialist. That is a more realistic interpretation of how we view the science on climate change at the
moment.
And
I think this comes back to this misinterpretation on free speech and on balanced arguments. So obviously the BBC is supposed to be impartial. It's supposed to present a balanced discussion. But the difficulty is, well, what constitutes a balanced discussion? And some people will think, well, you should have 50-50. You should argue both sides. But if in something like this, where you've got, 4,000 scientists who think that climate change is real and one person who doesn't, it's not right to put one against one, is it? It doesn't really work like that.
Mm. Mm. But liberal democracies do need, by essence, they have to air the views of everyone. So, and obviously denialists actually play on this as well. So they know that they use this to their advantage, even though the science has been, the basic science of climate change has proven.
Well, I do actually have to do a little bit of a shout out as well to somebody who actually has been lost from one of these sceptical communities, somebody called Mad Mike Hughes. I don't know if you saw this in the newspapers. He's actually, he died actually recently, which is very sad, but he's from the sort of denial side of it to the point of actually believing in flat earth theory. So it's like completely off one end of the spectrum. And sadly, he died actually trying to get a rocket up into space to try and prove some of this evidence. I think that's part of the difficulties, is that most people, the public, don't have access to what we have access to. And I think that's part of the issue, because they can't view this information for themselves. And a lot of people now are starting to mistrust, I think, what is said on the internet, what is said by, experts. Was it, who was it who said that we
Michael
don't need...
Gove.
Michael Gove. We don't need experts anymore, And I think that's part of the problem, is that they're wanting to do their own research and they think they can do that on Google, but there's so much misinformation out there. Part of the skills of coming to university is learning how to distinguish between the good information, the good sources, and the bad information, the bad sources. So I think that's something that everybody needs to be aware of. So if you are looking at any of the issues we talk about on From Mountains to Molecules, do remember that there is this issue of misinformation on the internet. So going back to our issue with Earth warming, but the humans aren't causing it. So we've got the climate change is a natural process. Global temperature is far higher in the Cretaceous period. What would you say about that?
Yes, well, it's certainly true that there's various natural drivers or factors that cause climate to vary, as well as, of course, more recently, humans. And certainly in the distant past, so you're talking about many millions of years ago, for example, during the Cretaceous, then we had hothouse relatively conditions with no polar ice caps in the way that we've got them today. So, yes, there have been big climate changes in the past, but we're generally talking about very long geologic timescales where these changes have happened or occurred over. And what's unusual about the recent increase in global temperatures, so particularly over the last few decades, the last century or so, is that if you compare what the global temperature's been doing then with the temperature in the past few thousands of years, for most of the last 10,000 years, in fact. And this is actually a very unusual rate of temperature increase, but it's also at the same time as the greenhouse gas increases as well that humans have put up into the atmosphere. And we do know that there is a direct physical link through having increased concentrations of carbon dioxide, methane, other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and trapping in more infrared radiation nearer the Earth's surface, which causes the global temperature rise.
So talking about carbon dioxide, CO2 that we call it, I mean, how does this work? I mean, why is it so important? I mean, if you think about how much CO2 there is in the atmosphere, it's a trace gas. You're talking about 0.04% of the atmosphere being made up of carbon dioxide, but we've got 21% of oxygen in there. Mm. I mean, why is it so bad?
Well, it's all to do with how these gases react with different types of energy or radiation in the atmosphere. So the greenhouse gases, like carbon dioxide and methane, they're relatively transparent to energy that's coming in from the sun, so short wavelength, optical waveband radiation, but they're fairly opaque in certain wavelengths to the radiation that is emitted by the Earth. So that's at much longer wavelengths, so infrared heat energy that these gases basically absorb very readily, and then they re-emit that radiation or some part of it back down to the Earth's surface. So it's all to do with the molecular reactions of different types of molecules in the atmosphere. Oxygen isn't reactive in the same way. It's not just to do with the amount of gas, but how it reacts with the radiation.
Right, okay, yeah. So so to put it in sort of thinking back to my GCSE science terms, so it kind of gets trapped in between the sort of within the atmosphere and between the atmosphere and the Earth. So it can get in, but the light can't get back out again. Yeah. And I suppose this is why it's called the greenhouse effect, isn't it? Because that's exactly how a greenhouse works. So, okay, so thinking about these natural causes then. So we talk about it being natural processes, some things that people have come up with, Earth's orbit, the sun, solar cycles, solar flares, all of these things could be causing it. Volcanoes emitting far more CO2 than humans. Those seem to be the go-to things when you're thinking about other causes of global warming. Andrew, what would you like to say about those?
Yeah, well, a lot of denialists would also say it's the sun.
Yeah.
But we've actually, in the last 50 years of global warming, the sun and climate have actually been going in opposite directions. And, you know, if it was the sun that was warming, we would expect to see it warming all layers of the atmosphere, whereas we actually only see warming at the surface in the troposphere, and then we see a cooling in the stratosphere. So that immediately debunks this idea that it's the sun that causes global warming. And, you know, anthropogenic emissions, i.e. human emissions, have been separated from, you know, the role of the sun, and there's plenty of scientific evidence out there to show that the current warming phase that we're in cannot be attributed alone to things like the sun.
And I think going on to the volcanoes bit, which is sort of my side of things, volcanoes emitting more than humans, I think people are thinking back to images that they have of, you know, dinosaur times and where they see these volcanoes emitting stuff, potentially things like Krakatoa, Toba Tambora, some of these very major eruptions that we have. But actually, we don't have those major eruptions very often. And when we do have them, the effects are quite short term. And generally, they actually lead to more cooling than warming. They certainly don't create this warming effect to the same extent as, you know, eruptions like the Deccan Traps might have had, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of years ago. So we're just not in a situation where that happens. Humans are currently emitting 100 times more carbon dioxide than modern volcanoes. So this idea that volcanoes or the sun are causing this warming has been completely debunked by science. That there is absolutely no evidence that this is the case. I think that's a really important thing to say. So just to finish off today then, we'd like to look at a little bit of phase three. So if we've convinced you now that global warming is happening, we are having an effect on this, but maybe you still don't want to worry about it too much, then let's have a think about this phase of resignation, that climate change is real, but actually, you know, there's some benefits to it. So thinking about this, animals and plants can adapt. Edward, what do you think about this idea?
Well, they can adapt to a certain extent, but of course it's all the changes to the environment that we're making, in addition to climate change, so land use changes as well, so reducing, removing corridors that animals, the species can migrate along, for example, and building new homes which are badly needed. But of course, this has effects on ecosystems at the local regional level. So regarding climate change through human activity, again, that's fairly rapid compared with climate changes that have typically naturally occurred over the last few thousand years. So it's really the rate of change that is challenging for species which might already be near the brink to adjust to, particularly when they've got nowhere to easily migrate into. So I think there are some real challenges, but it's compounded by other issues, human pressures on the environment.
So this idea that the change is very rapid and there's nowhere to run, basically, that you combine those two things together and the animals and I suppose plants and things like that will also have issues, won't they? And humans as well. If you think about some of the places we had some visitors over from, wasn't it Tuvalu, I think, they came over from? And I was talking to some of the young people there from the university, and they said that they've seen this sea level rise and they've seen the flooding and they've seen parts of their islands disappear, which I think is awful. And people are going to have to, and people can say, well, you can just move out of those and move to somewhere else. Where are they going to move to? These people have grown up there. If somebody came to you and said, move out of your house, you know, you're going next door, you probably wouldn't like it. You know, it's still your home, isn't it? So then to finish off then, it's only a few degrees. I mean, we're talking, you know, 1, 2, 3 degrees at most, you know, global warming. I mean, surely that's not going to make much difference. I mean, I turn my thermostat up and down in the house and far more than that.
Well, the issue is it's only 1 or 2 degrees, but the Earth is such a sensitive system and it's very sensitive to minute changes in temperature change. So just as an example, the 2003 heat waves that we experienced in Europe, you know, 15,000 odd died in France 15 years ago, that sort of heat wave would be typical in another 100 years with like a 1.5 or with a 1.5 to 2 degree warming. So if we continue on our current emission pathway, which we're doing now, those sort of events would be very much typical every few years by 2100. So it has a marked increase, and obviously that has implications for how we actually implement policy as a society, because obviously the majority of those people that died in the heat wave were elderly people that didn't have access to water. People couldn't get to them on time to actually save the lives. So this is where we see the physical stuff happening and having an adverse effect on our social and political institutions.
Yeah, it's incredible the amount of differences this, you know, it's a 1.5 degree sea change can have, isn't it? It's quite phenomenal. So just as a final thing then, putting you guys on the spot here a little bit, what sort of things would you like to see happening? I'm assuming that you're both, neither of you are climate change deniers. I'm assuming you'd both like to see climate change, the impacts of climate change be reduced. What would you suggest could be done? What stage are we at now?
Okay, well, you're right saying that I'm not a climate change denier, but I'm a climate change sceptic. Mm. And this is what I actually was teaching third year undergraduates yesterday on policy and politics of climate change. And we were talking about climate scepticism and denialism. And I was saying that it's important to be a sceptic. So you just question everything on science. You do have to question everything. And we're sceptical as academics because our papers go through a peer review process. So they're scrutinised, you know, blind peer-reviewed, and then if the editor wants to publish it, he takes all of those reviewer comments into consideration, and then the paper gets published. And I think what I would like to see now is society becoming more attuned to the science of climate change. And this is a really good, important example that I'd like to... I read something today in the newspaper about climate denialists, how they've actually got their actual, what we call, anti-Greta. And it's a German girl. She's 19 years old. Her name's Naomi Siebt. And she has done a lot of work on social media saying, well, the scientific consensus on climate change needs to be more heavily scrutinised. And climate denialists, think tanks, etc., have got hold of this, and they've actually funded her to work for her. So places like the Heartland Institute, which is a right-wing think tank in the United States of America that's funded by the Koch brothers.
It's linked to the White House, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it has obvious links to Trump's administration as well. Yeah. And you can see them now trying to incorporate sort of this 19-year-old girl, teenager, into their ideological battle on climate change. So the ideological battle on climate change is far from over. Yes, you know, it still ensues. But I think the way that we need to actually find a solution to this is actually to bring more youth into the argument. And I think the fact that we've got Greta talking about climate change has sobered up adults a little bit into, well, this thing is real and we have to do something about it. And the Extinction Rebellion stuff has also been helpful, you know. It's sort of reconstituting what I call the new civil politics of climate change in the UK.
So you'd support the climate strikes and things that the kids are doing at the schools?
I think it's a good thing because, you know, it actually teaches them to be critical about contemporary real-world problems, not just learn about it in the classroom. They're actually part of the action. So it's moving from just understanding a concept into actually acting on it. And that's what we've failed to do as adults, I think, the last 30, 40 years.
And I think that's what she's pointing out, isn't it, really, that actually, you know, the adults have sort of failed to deal with this, and now the children are having to step in. Hopefully they'll be the adults of the future and things might change. So, Edward, what about you? What would you like to see happen from now on?
Well, I think it's very interesting how the public perception of climate change appears to be changing somewhat in the last year or so. I think, however, there's a lot more to be done, obviously, as Andrew says. And I think whilst it's certainly critical that we engage the youth and embrace what they're doing, I think obviously it's still adults who are mainly the ones with the power. So I think it's quite crucial that we try to engage segments of the population who perhaps won't be directly involved with or taking on board arguments from Extinction Rebellion, those sort of protests, for example. So I think there is also room for a more moderate approach that brings in larger swaths of the population. But I do agree with Andrew that I think the time for action, that we've had a lot of relative inaction over the last 30 years. And if we look at what's happening with the climate system, then it's actually deeply concerning that we've done so little over the last few decades. But I think we will need solutions also to be led by, but also by business and economics as well, that obviously drives much of consumer behaviour. So I think we basically need action from everyone. That's my view.
We are a rock revolving around a golden sun. We are a billion children rolled into one. So when I hear about the hole in the sky, salt water wells in my eyes. We climb the highest mountain, we'll make the desert bloom. We're so ingenious, we can walk on the moon. But when I hear of how the forests have died, salt water wells in my eyes. I have lived for love, but now that's not enough. For the world I love is dying.
On to our next section of the show, which is fact or alternative facts. So I've got a couple of things to ask you. We actually have three bits of information. One of these bits of information is sort of true, and the other ones are not. So facts and alternative facts. So first of all, the bubbles in boiling water contain empty space. Vacuums is number one. Number two. Steam is colourless and invisible to the naked eye. And number three, metals are colder than wood or plastic. So thinking about those, so we can test some of these. What do you guys think bubbles in boiling water contain? What are they made from?
Silence.
I would have assumed gas.
I thought initially it is like air dissolved in the water, and then gradually it changed to the like vapor that which is like the shift change of the water to the.
Right. Okay. So what do you guys reckon is inside the these bubbles in the water? Well, we're stuck on that one, aren't we?
I've already heard something.
Okay. So. Next one then. Steam is colourless and invisible to the naked eye. What are your thoughts on that?
I can see steam.
Okay.
Yes. I think yes.
But maybe this is a trick.
Yeah. No, is it a
trick? Okay, so, all right then. And the last one then, we can test this out, all right guys? So, metals are colder than wood or plastic. So we have here a piece of metal here, and we have some plastic here. So would you like to hold on to the piece of metal and the piece of plastic? Okay, and then pass it on to the others. What do you reckon? Which one is the lower temperature? Which one's colder? What do you think?
Well, I feel like the obvious answer is the metal, but I also feel like that means that it's not the right answer, because isn't it to do with the way that it absorbs heat?
Okay then, so out of those three then, the bubbles in boiling water contain empty space or vacuums, steam is colourless and invisible to the naked eye, and metals are colder than wood or plastic. Which one of those is the true fact?
I kind of want to say with maybe the first one.
I think the second one.
And you're going for the second one. So you're going for the steam is colourless and you're going for the bubbles in boiling water contain empty space.
I kind of agree with the steam because... I feel like it's a trick, because I can see steam.
You can call these tricks.
Yeah.
Okay, so the bubbles in boiling water contain empty space is false. It's an alternative fact.
Ooh.
The bubbles actually contain water vapour, which is what Mia was saying. So, yeah, if you think about it, I mean, that's where the bubbles come from. It's just the water turning into gas, but it's deep down in the water and it rises up.
Yeah, see, I thought there was going to be something going on here with atoms and empty spaces.
Far more simple than that.
Way too complicated.
But it's one of those questions that you never think about. So it's, yeah, these are interesting ones. So the next one then, so steam is colourless and invisible to the naked eye is actually a fact. So when we see steam, we actually see the condensing of the steam back into water. So we don't see the steam itself, which is below that. So when you boil a kettle, you've got kind of that invisible bit, and then you have the steam a little bit higher up as it condenses. So yeah, steam is colourless and invisible to the naked eye. So the last one, metals are colder than wood or plastic. So why do we think that metals have a lower temperature than wood and plastic? What makes us think that?
I think Holly described it like metal absorb the heat more.
Yeah, so when you touch metal, it feels cold, doesn't it? If you had something metal and you touch something wooden, they both feel cold. But if you think about it logically, what does everything end up at? What temperature does everything end up at if you leave it somewhere? It ends up at room temperature. So everything, including the metal, must be, if you measured its temperature, at room temperature. So Holly, explain again, why does it feel colder?
Well, I thought it was to do with the fact that it absorbs the heat. So is it not that in metal, there are free electrons that can move around, so they absorb the heat energy that you're inputting from your hand.
That's it. They're fantastic conductors. We learn this, don't we? Right from junior school, really, that metals are excellent conductors of heat and electricity. So that is why metals feel colder than wood and plastic. Fantastic. Okay, so I'd like to say thank you to our producer Alex for putting up with us today as usual, and to Mio, Holly and Trudy, and from myself, Josephine, thank you very much for being with us.
Listen to the wind blow down,